Dawson of Penn killed many men. That's why we sing God Save the King. That was a popular rhyme in England in 1936, with a deadly core of truth to it. How is it possible for one man to get away with murdering a king in plain sight? Committing the crime of regicide, no less. This is how.
There was a hush about Sandringham House. Courtiers tread softly on the carpeted corridors. Glances and whispers were lowered. The flag would soon be lowered to half-mast too. The Prime Minister was informed of the imminent announcement, and the Times of London was told to hold its front page for the morning edition. It was the 20th of January 1936, and the death of King George V of England was widely expected. Public officers were ready to commence the processes of national mourning. The tributes and obituaries were polished and readied. A few people gathered expectantly at the gates of Buckingham Palace, awaiting the inevitable announcement pinned to the gate. Inside Sandringham House, which is in Norfolk on the east coast of England, in the bedroom of the king there was a watchful calm. The king had been ill for some time, in fact, since the war which ended 18 years before, and as a heavy smoker he was prone to bronchial ailments. He had spent most of 1929 recuperating at Bognor, for which honour Bognor was renamed Bognor Regis, the Latin for of the king. According to one version of events, the king's last words were spoken to his private secretary, of whom he asked, "How is the empire?" "All's well with the empire, sir," was the reply. Another account of his final words, which has passed into legend, was that when informed that he would soon be well enough to travel to Bognor to recover his health, he opened one eye and growled, "Bugger Bognor!" Thus did the gruff but popular old king shrug off Bognor and the imminent prospect of his own death. Whatever the accepted version, King George V spoke his last words. He then lapsed into a state of unconsciousness. The light left his eyes, and the eldest of Queen Victoria's grandsons passed away. That was the story which in various forms held sway as the official version of the death of the monarch for half a century. But it wasn't true. 50 years later, when the diary of King George V's doctor, Bertrand Dawson, Lord Dawson of Penn, was examined, it revealed an extraordinary tale. This was in 1986, and the description of the king's death was startlingly candid. First, he said, he instructed the king's Irish nurse, Catherine Black, to give the king a sedative. As she went to do this, the king spoke his actual last words. "God damn you," he said. Then, wrote Dawson, "At about 11 o'clock I decided to determine the end, and injected 3/4 of a grain of morphia, and shortly afterwards 1 grain of cocaine, into the king's distended jugular vein." In other words, the king had been deliberately and unlawfully killed by his doctor. In fact, as it was done as a matter of direct intention, the highest level of mens re in English law, King George V had been murdered. George was born into the house of Saxe-Coburg and Gotha in 1865, the second son of Prince Edward, future King Edward VII. He was close to his elder brother, Albert Edward, and the two were educated together by private tutor, with whom they travelled widely, acquiring matching tattoos in Japan even, after which they joined the Royal Navy. It was a happy time for George, but then tragedy struck. His brother Albert died in the influenza pandemic of 1892. George was deeply affected by the loss of his elder brother. There was just 17 months between them, and it changed his life. He was now elevated to second in line to the throne, behind his father, Edward. In 1893 he married his deceased brother's fiancée, Mary of Teck, and the couple had 5 sons, one of whom died at the age of 13, and a daughter. George was a strict father, apparently, and his sons were described as being terrified of him. The family lived at York Cottage on the Sandringham Estate in Norfolk, which George loved. Here he was able to indulge his two passions in life, stamp collecting and shooting. After the death of Queen Victoria in 1901, George's father became King Edward VII, and George became direct heir to the throne. He and his wife Mary toured the world, undertaking the duties of first-rank royals, and when Edward VII died in 1910, George became King George V, and his wife Queen Mary. George was a conscientious man, applied himself diligently to his office as king, and did his best to involve himself in the major issues of his reign: the rise of socialism, communism, and fascism, the creation of the Irish Free State and subsequent partition of Ireland, women's suffrage, and, of course, the cataclysmic advent of World War I. The war was a personal catastrophe for George. Kaiser Wilhelm II of Germany was his first cousin, another of Queen Victoria's grandsons. He himself held German titles, yet he called a council on the morning of the 4th of August 1914 to declare war on Germany. He was horrified by the immense loss of life which took place in the trenches on the Western Front when 50,000 men fell on the first morning of the Somme. George was aghast. He regarded the war as a pointless waste of life. It was a time of despair for him, but one which required fortitude, a quality he possessed. But it aged him. In 1917, George altered the surname of his house from Saxe-Coburg-Gotha to Windsor to assuage public anti-German feeling. George was seen as a wise and moderate king, but he made many mistakes in his reign too. In 1917, the Russian Revolution overthrew another cousin, Tsar Nicholas II, and the British government wished to offer asylum to the Tsar and his family. But George, fearing unrest and revolution at home, blocked this. When the Tsar and his immediate family were executed by the Bolsheviks the following year in 1918, he felt guilt and self-reproach for this failure on his part. He felt it for the rest of his life. But he learned from his mistakes. In 1919, a British warship rescued the Tsar's mother and surviving members of the family from the Crimea. His relations with his eldest son and heir, Edward, Prince of Wales, were fractious, and they worsened throughout the 1920s, during which time Prince Edward was involved in a string of sexual affairs with married women, habituated brothels, and narrowly escaped scandals which would have rocked the monarchy had it not been for the compliance of the newspaper barons in suppressing these matters in Britain. George's health was always precarious. He had many serious illnesses during the course of his life, and suffered chronic recurrent bronchitis. He was obliged to take a long break in 1925 as a result of illness. In 1928 he was close to death with septicemia and spent much of 1929 recovering from this at Bognor. On the evening of the 15th of January 1936, George developed a bad cold, which, as ever, descended to his chest. He took to his bed, and though he did not know it, he would not leave the room alive. 5 days later, on the morning of the 20th of January, Dawson of Penn, his doctor, issued a statement. "The king's life is moving peacefully towards its close," it stated. At 11:55 that evening, George V died. Of course, George V's death was not wholly unexpected. He had suffered ill health for many years. His bronchial illnesses were not helped by the fact he was a heavy smoker. But he somehow always came through. In 1928 it had been thought his demise was imminent, but he defied the medics by recovering from septicemia on that occasion. When illness struck again in mid-January 1936, the press and government were informed he was gravely ill. Stanley Baldwin, the Prime Minister, visited him, and later said his waking inquiries were kindly ones. He was in a gentle condition. He was weak, but did not appear to be suffering greatly. The matter was in the hands of Providence. In this case, as we now know, Providence received a helping hand from Lord Dawson. His suggestion in his diary is that he did this as an act of mercy to a dying man. However, the matter is by no means as straightforward as this. We are entitled to examine the matter from the point of view of the first principles of inquiry and consider the circumstances of the king's death as a police inquiry would have done had it taken place in 1936. And from this position, Dawson, at least in a technical sense, committed the most serious of criminal offences against the king. And it was something a great deal more than this. What we know of the death of the king we owe almost entirely to Dawson's account. Catherine Black, the royal nurse present at the time, who wrote her autobiography in 1939, did not allude to the details, nor to the fact that Dawson had asked her, and she had refused, to give the king the lethal injection. That she should omit this shocking event from her memoirs is scarcely surprising. Dawson was a powerful man, a peer of the realm, a friend of the Prince of Wales, a member of the Privy Council, the foremost doctor in the land. To give her account would be to accuse him, quite plainly, of murder. She kept quiet about the incident. She had little choice. Dawson himself gives three reasons in his diary for taking the actions which resulted directly in the king's death. First, because the king deserved to die in a dignified manner, not a lingering one. Second, because his family deserved this, rather than the uncertainty and anguish of a prolonged death. And third, because if the king did not die before midnight, his death would miss the headlines of the Times, and be reported first in what he described as less appropriate evening journals. The final reason given here is peculiar, and to suggest that the timing of the king's death, even as an additional motive, was considered, is thoroughly reprehensible. And it reveals something of Dawson's character, his snobbery and the value he attached to form and outward appearance. The reasons he gives are also not entirely consistent with each other, and most importantly, none of these motivations were in the purview of his authority. Dawson claims the decision to act in taking the king's life is his, but he also says, with some ambiguity, that the family wished him to act without unnecessarily prolonging the life of the king. What that might mean and how it should be interpreted is unclear. But we do know that his wife Queen Mary was present, and Prince Edward his heir had arrived at Sandringham during this period. In fact, realistically, only two people could have been consulted in the matter of George's treatment: Queen Mary his wife, and the man who would be king, his eldest son, Edward, Prince of Wales. Did Dawson receive permission, implied or otherwise, from either of these people to act as he did? He does not say so, beyond referring generally to the family's wishes concerning prolonging the king's life. This brings us to the question of euthanasia, whether or not Dawson was right to euthanize the king, hastening his death as an act of mercy. And that is essentially the course the debate has followed in this matter since 1986 and the discovery that Dawson ended the king's life. It has thus been considered purely as a case of medical ethics. The proposition is that Dawson took King George's life as a means, albeit illegal, of easing the king's passing. That appears to be, in part, Dawson's claim confided to his diary. It can certainly be inferred from this that this was his motivation. Dawson was known to believe euthanasia should be the decision of the doctor rather than a policy. But it is clear from his account, and from those of others, that George V was conscious and capable of speech at the time Dawson took his decision to end his life. It is also clear that Dawson did not seek the king's permission or consent, implied or otherwise, to act as he did. That makes euthanasia, certainly of a kind which involves consent, wholly improbable. In fact, the king's actual last words, "God damn you," suggest he had a strong and well-founded suspicion of what lay in wait for him at the hands of Dawson. The question of how ill the king was and whether or not his end was inevitable is a matter of complete conjecture, but it does not alter Dawson's act or mitigate it in law. His act could not be considered as manslaughter because manslaughter implies the unintentional killing of another person. Murder is an act involving intention. By Dawson's own words and account, there is clear, direct intention expressed. The mens rea, or intention, of murder is therefore fully satisfied. It is also the case that before 1957 it was not a settled principle that a doctor who, during the course of treating a patient who is seriously ill, inadvertently causes their death, is not guilty of unlawful killing. This would only be established at the trial of Dr. John Bodkin Adams in 1957. But 20 years earlier, in 1936, no such appurtenance existed, so it could not apply to the actions of Lord Dawson. And in any case, the circumstances here are entirely different. Dawson, by his own admission, took actions which were deliberate and designed to cause death. Neither treatment nor alleviation of symptoms could therefore be used to mitigate his act. He further compounded this by falsifying the king's death certificate, attributing the cause of his death to lung disease, which it was not. There is no autopsy or inquest into the death of a monarch. Had there been a post-mortem, perhaps conducted by the preeminent pathologist of the day, Sir Bernard Spilsbury, and the king's organs analysed by Dr. Roche Lynch of St. Mary's, Paddington, then the cause of George's death would have shown that the king had died from a lethal overdose of morphine and cocaine, administered to his jugular vein in the certain knowledge that it would cause his death. Had Dawson's diary been discovered at the time, a coroner and jury at an inquest would have been bound to return a verdict of murder against Lord Dawson of Penn. It is difficult to second-guess Dawson's medical opinion that the king was going to die in a few hours, since we do not have the benefit of an autopsy report, nor is it possible to know what the outcome might have been. But we do know that King George had been declared close to death on at least 2 previous occasions, in 1925 and 1928, and had survived these. We also know that George had taken to his bed just 5 days before his death, ostensibly with a cold, and that his condition was said to have been worsened in that period to become a life-threatening one. The shortness of the space of time between the onset of the illness and its progression to the point at which Dawson decided it to be terminal is remarkable. Given that it was initially diagnosed as a cold, its progression in terms of its seriousness is equally remarkable. The absence of George's other physicians on the evening of his death, and Dawson's solitary presence at the king's bedside, excepting the nurse Catherine Black, so late in the evening, do nothing to reassure us on Dawson's motives and actions. And there are some other indications that Dawson was a little too quick with his recourse to lethal injections. In December 1935, just weeks before George became ill, his sister, Princess Victoria, died. It threw George into depression. He was close to her. She was given a blood transfusion. Her doctor on this occasion was Bernard Dawson. This was probably mere coincidence, but the run of bad luck for the family did not end there. 2 years after George's death, his sister, Queen Maud of Norway, visited London. She was in excellent health. While in London, she became ill, and Dawson and a colleague were called. Dawson recommended an operation, which he carried out. It was a success. But 4 days later, she died quite unexpectedly, of heart failure, just after midnight. In time for the morning papers, in fact. Dawson wrote to her doctor in Norway, "You will agree that the Queen's sudden death was a relief which saved her from the last painful stages of a disease." It was a peculiar death, and Dawson's suggestion that it was a relief is extraordinary, given that there was no suggestion of illness when she left Norway. She left Norway in good health and returned in a lead-lined coffin. 3 royal siblings, 2 of them monarchs, died in the space of 3 years, and all were under the same doctor. It certainly caused suspicions at the time, because a popular rhyme alluded to this. Dawson of Penn killed many men. That's why we sing, God Save the King. Who penned this rhyme is not known, but its author was clearly someone who had suspicions, possibly another doctor in the royal household, sceptical as to the suddenness of George's death, and perhaps also to its fortuitousness. It has been proposed that a possible reason for Dawson's actions, not committed to his diary, was that Dawson, who had a busy and highly lucrative private practice in London, might have decided to end the king's life that evening because of the inconvenience it might cause to himself and his own interests. Another reason given has been that Dawson had indicated the king would die, and if the king did not oblige in this, in a timely manner, it would damage his, Dawson's, reputation. He cared about such things, perhaps excessively. However, none of the reasons given, including those of Dawson himself, in my view, are sufficient to explain what occurred. All may have factored into the decision Dawson took. It would be surprising if they did not. But none are sufficient as an explanation for what occurred and for Dawson's admission of the matter in his diary. At the heart of this is the character and background of Bertrand Dawson. He was a highly unusual man. Dawson was born in 1864 into a middle-class family in Croydon. His father was an architect, and the family were comfortably off, but not in the first rank of society. Dawson was educated at St. Paul's School, London, and then studied medicine at University College, London, before qualifying as a doctor in 1893. From the beginning, it was clear Dawson would not be content to be a family general practitioner, nor even a consultant. He was a hugely ambitious man, and clawed his way quickly up the ranks of the medical profession. He was keen to observe the dignity of rank, too, and in 1900 he married Minnie Yarrow, the daughter of the shipping magnate Sir Alfred Yarrow. It was perhaps a statement of intent. Here was a man who intended to rise to the highest echelons of society. He did all he could in furtherance of this ambition. He became a fellow of the Royal Society of Physicians in 1903. He volunteered for the Army Medical Reserve, and in 1907 he was appointed to the team of physicians in the household of Edward VII. During the war he was appointed Major General in the Royal Army Medical Corps, and in 1916 he was knighted. He was made a baronet in 1920, and in 1929 was elevated to the peerage, being appointed to the House of Lords as Lord Dawson of Penn. It was a remarkable career, but it also demonstrates something of Dawson's political nous and his burning ambitions. He was a man who relished his royal associations, who cared about rank, and by the 1930s, Dawson counted Edward, Prince of Wales, amongst his friends. These considerations seem to have eclipsed any abilities he may have had as a physician. He was a society doctor. He had a Harley Street practice and a home in Wimpole Street, Mayfair. His wife was wealthy, and he could command the highest fees of his upmarket patients as the physician of the royal family. Dr. Dawson was unquestionably addicted to the outward appearances of success. Public approbation and attention seemed to have mattered greatly to him. It caused him to take risks where caution was indicated. And there is, moreover, something peculiar in Dawson's administering exclusively to the rich and powerful, a sense that in his doing so it somehow increased his own prestige and position. It is a dangerous quality in a doctor. The satisfaction of saving life, of curing people from every walk of life, and relieving them of pain, is enough for almost all doctors. But Dawson's focus was exclusively, socially and professionally, on the highest strata of society. He was a man of arrogance, too. It made him unpopular with his colleagues. He didn't consult with them. He acted alone, and in this he was blessed with supreme self-confidence. He never doubted himself. In 1928, when George V was seriously ill with bronchial pneumonia, he decided to operate alone. The operation was hugely risky. He should have taken counsel with experts in this field. It was his professional duty to do so. But he didn't, and he consulted none of the other royal physicians either. They were furious at this. He had acted recklessly with the king's life. But the operation was a success, or at least the king recovered, and Dawson had the credit of it. He loved this. It earned him his peerage. He had unrivalled access to the royal household afterwards. His standing was high. His celebrity was increased. Rather too much for a doctor, his colleagues thought. This argument can be taken only so far, but there is sufficient evidence to support the notion that Dawson had a predilection for euthanizing his patients, and also that this may have gone beyond medical and moral conviction, so that it had a psychological basis rooted in his need to exercise power and to promote himself to the centre of the stage. What greater power can a person exercise than that over a king's life? But it should also be recognized that Dawson's motives in this were complex. It seems to me highly probable the reasons he alluded to in his diary were there in the mix. Also the practical one, attributed to his actions concerning the inconvenience to himself of George lingering. To what extent he was prepared to admit these to himself, or even recognized the complex mixture of prompts to his actions, we can never know. But the ones he gave in his diary are, in themselves, insufficient for the action he took, that of murder. But there is one other circumstance which is probably the agent which binds all the other motives together. It is one which has been entirely ignored since Dawson's act was discovered in 1986, and yet it is an elephant hiding in the room. It concerns the position of his son, Edward, and his desire to marry the American socialite, Wallis Simpson. Relations between George and his eldest son, Edward, amounted to a deep mutual loathing by 1935. Edward resented his father's imperious attitude to him, and regarded him as an overbearing tyrant. George regarded his son as an immoral wastrel, a liar, and a man of perverted sexual appetites. A long series of affairs with married women, his habituation of brothels, and being the source of seemingly endless scandals and their suppression, had convinced him that his son was utterly unsuited to be king. He had written in his diary, "Within 12 months of my death, the boy will have ruined himself." Prophetic words. Since 1934, Edward had been seeing another married woman, Mrs. Wallis Simpson. Wallis Simpson was American. She had been born Bessie Wallis Warfield in Blue Ridge Summit on the Pennsylvania-Maryland border in 1896. She married a U.S. naval officer in 1916. It was a rocky marriage which finally ended in divorce in 1927. By this time, she was involved with a British shipping executive called Ernest Simpson, whom she married. Simpson ran into financial difficulties, and soon after, Wallis was introduced to Edward, Prince of Wales. The two quickly became lovers. Wallis was brusque, domineering, and irreverent, and Edward liked it. It was soon apparent that she had a powerful psychosexual hold over him. Divorced once and now married to another man, the king and his advisers, personal and political, had the lowest opinion of Mrs. Simpson. Although the king and Queen Mary had met her once, they had since refused to receive her. She was, in royal circles, persona non grata. When George V furiously accused Edward of keeping Wallis Simpson as his latest mistress, Edward, true to form, denied it. He lied, of course, something which would hardly have surprised his father. But it was an open secret that Mrs. Simpson was Edward's mistress. Courtiers had seen the couple in bed together. The extent of their relationship and its nature was the subject of whispers and ribald gossip, even of a BBC retraction when a live radio programme featuring a disparaging sexual comment concerning Mrs. Simpson was made. By 1935, the phone calls of Edward and Wallis were being intercepted by the Home Office. Special Branch was trailing Mrs. Simpson. The FBI and British intelligence reported that Mrs. Simpson had other lovers. including senior German ones. Apparently, she slept with Ribbentrop in 1936, the Nazi German ambassador to London, who was later hanged at Nuremberg. It was also believed that she was passing information to Germany, and that Edward's official papers as Prince of Wales were compromised. The American ambassador, Joseph Kennedy, patriarch of the Kennedy clan and father of the future U.S. President JFK, described her frankly as a tart and refused to dine with her. The Archbishop of Canterbury was aghast, and his chaplain believed Mrs. Simpson's hold on the Prince of Wales was of a perverted sexual nature. Queen Mary had also been informed her son was sexually abnormal. Edward's own private secretary, Alan Lascelles, had told Prime Minister Stanley Baldwin candidly as early as 1927 that in view of Edward's affairs, the best thing for the country and the monarchy would be for an accident to occur to Edward. George V did not want Edward to be king. He wished fervently that his errant son should have no children. He confided to his diary that he wished the succession to pass to his second son, George, known as Bertie, and thence to his granddaughter, Elizabeth. Lilibet, he nicknamed her, although barely 10 years old at the time. By 1935, speculation and gossip concerning Mrs. Simpson had hardened into fact. Although still kept from the British public, it was known abroad and in society and government that Edward was besotted with Wallis Simpson, spent all his free time with her, and much of that which was not free. He caused a scandal in Scotland when he declined to open a hospital wing due to prior engagements, and then was pictured frolicking in the Mediterranean with Wallis Simpson on the day of the prior engagement. It was becoming increasingly clear that Edward wished to marry Wallis Simpson, although she was still married at the time, and that she wished to marry Edward by way, it was believed, of personal advancement. Of course, there was not a cat in hell's chance of the couple receiving King George's permission to marry. Nevertheless, in spite of all attempts to separate the couple, Edward refused to give up Mrs. Simpson. There could be no mistaking it. By late 1935, the darkening clouds of a constitutional crisis were gathering. But Edward was not without his friends and supporters. The newspaper mogul Beaverbrook supported him. Oswald Mosley, leader of the British Union of Fascists, did too. Another of Edward's supporters was Dr. Bertrand Dawson. Subsequently, Dawson would prove himself and his allegiance to Edward after George V's death, when he undertook to persuade Prime Minister Baldwin to stand down on health grounds. Baldwin, by that time, was implacably opposed to further indulge Edward's ambitions towards Mrs. Simpson. Dawson hoped to persuade Baldwin his heart was weak and thereby clear the way for Edward. But Baldwin's heart proved to be in excellent shape, and Dawson was obliged to accept the assessment made by another doctor on this. In 1935, Edward had a belief that if he could force the issue from his position as King of England, the government would be obliged to accept the matter as a fait accompli. But of course Edward was not King of England in 1935, and the man who was, his father, had utter contempt for his son, and in the unlikely event Edward would ever have dared to seek his father's permission for his marriage to Wallis Simpson, he knew full well that his request would meet with a brusque dismissal. Then, in January 1936, King George was taken ill with a cold. Such conditions always affected the king's chest, but he had been here before. What the outcome of his illness on this occasion might be cannot now be known. Dawson said he did not consult the family directly on the decision he made to end the king's life, but he also says he had been told by the family not to prolong the king's life unnecessarily. It is extremely difficult to interpret what this may have meant, what may have been implied, and how Dawson may have interpreted this. Was it an intimation to end the king's life? From whom did he receive this intimation? Queen Mary? Or the Prince of Wales himself, the man who would become king the very moment his father exhaled his last breath. We do not know because Dawson does not declare this. And this brings us to the key question. That is, did Edward, Prince of Wales, or Queen Mary give permission, or an implied consent to Dawson, to end the king's life? The facts are clear. The king was very ill. But whether he died now or in the coming days, or made another of his miraculous recoveries, is unknown. That understanding is implicit in Dawson's reasons he lays down for his act. He wishes to make certain that which is uncertain. The demise of the king might indeed ease the anxiety of the family and allow him to die without prolonging his suffering. But this is not an unusual end-of-life situation, and it does not provide sufficient reason for taking a person's life, and especially when that person is conscious and capable of communicating his wishes. The family at Sandringham at this time, and in dialogue with Dawson, can only have been George's wife and his eldest son, Edward. But it seems unlikely that George's devoted wife would urge her husband's death. She was religious. The couple were close. In 1929, one of the doctors treating George attributed the king's recovery from his serious illness not to Dawson, but to Mary's attentiveness to him. And however painful it might be to see her husband suffer, it is human nature that she would not wish to let him go. Mary was of such a character that she would not easily give up. She would have hoped that he would pull through, as he had before with her help, however dire the prognosis, because she had heard such prognoses before. Edward had a different perspective. With his hatred of his father, his wishes in the matter can hardly be doubted. Edward had no regard for anything but his own desires and their satisfaction. When his 13-year-old brother died in 1919, he called it merely a regrettable nuisance. His mother had broken with him over the unfeeling letter he wrote to her on that occasion. Edward had a casual disregard for others. It seems unlikely mother and son would be in accord in the matter of George's illness. It is worth mentioning in passing, too, that the 13-year-old prince who died, Johnny, was epileptic, and there was embarrassment in those days about such illnesses. The family was embarrassed, but death from epilepsy is rare. Unless your doctor happens to be Lord Dawson of Penn, that is, which it was on this occasion. Edward would hope his father died, of course. The question is, at what point does a hope become a wish, and a wish become an intention? An intention espoused to another, and in its progression tip over the threshold into an instruction to murder. The law sets the bar of proof high in this respect. Powerful people seldom need to express their intentions more forcefully than wishes, or to expose themselves to complicity in murder. Their minions interpret their wishes correctly. It is a matter of natural selection in such people that they do so, and act accordingly. And then there is the matter of Edward's character. His actions, as his words, reveal a man peculiarly devoid of empathy for others. The only thing he minded was his own comfort and pleasure. And these were, since the summer of 1934, inextricably bound up in Mrs. Simpson. There can be little doubt he wished his father dead. He was the obstacle to all he desired. He knew he could never marry Mrs. Simpson while his father lived, and he believed he could force the issue with the government from his strengthened position as king. He was wrong. He was wrong about many things in his life. He was wrong about Hitler, about the fascist movement, about his close friend Oswald Mosley. Wrong when he described the Jews as responsible for the problems of the world. Wrong in his belief in white supremacy. He cavorted with prostitutes behind the lines, while hundreds of thousands of young men, his less fortunate compatriots, fell in the trenches of France during the First World War. His mistress of that time, Marguerite d'Alibert, shot her husband dead in the London Savoy in 1923, and the matter was hushed up. She got away with it, quite probably because she had compromising letters from Edward in her possession. she got away with murder, and Edward was hurried off to Canada for the year. It was not known for decades that a woman tried at the Old Bailey for murder had been the Prince of Wales's mistress. No mention of it was allowed in court. In later years, Edward was involved in currency smuggling. He was not an admirable man. Had he been born to a lowlier social status, he would probably have been a petty thief, in and out of prison, as a persistent offender. But he wasn't. He was heir to the throne of England, and it is quite inconceivable that Dawson would not have counselled his opinion in the condition, treatment, and prospects of his father, nor that Edward would have given this, probably far more candidly than was necessary to a man like Dawson. And it was from such a platform that Dawson could make a decision to end the king's life. All the stars in his firmament were in perfect alignment. We do not know what happened in precise terms, but it can be surmised with a high degree of probability. There was a tension in royal circles. An aging king and a dissolute heir were at loggerheads. The son was attempting to insinuate his equally disreputable mistress into royal circles. Initially, he had some success, but as soon as the nature of this relationship was known, the drawbridge came up. The king and queen refused to receive Mrs. Simpson. Edward was forced into his familiar condition, that of lying. But the jig was up. British intelligence knew. So did U.S. intelligence. Prime Minister Stanley Baldwin was kept fully informed of the matter. It was Baldwin's duty, as the king's first adviser, to make absolutely plain in whatever diplomatic terms were necessary to the king the nature of the relationship existing between the heir to the throne and Mrs. Simpson. It was his duty also to present to him the difficulties such a match would present to the monarchy, to the church and empire. A man of King George's experience would hardly need this to be spelled out to him. He refused to receive Mrs. Simpson. He upbraided his son. The U.S. ambassador shunned her too. She was adrift from every avenue of public life in England. But Edward would not be turned from his ruinous course. Although weak and vacuous, he had a certain peevishness, a needling persistence in his character, a petulance when thwarted. It was a scandal that the heir to the throne should publicly cavort with a twice-married, still-married woman. A man who, even when his father died, would become head of the Church of England. Yet Edward was unrepentant. He was prepared to sit out his father's declining years to have his way. But was Mrs. Simpson? She had other affairs, certainly. Did Edward know of these? Of course he did. It would be too great a temptation for those who wished to frustrate Edward's relationship with Mrs. Simpson not to ensure that he learned of such affairs in the hope of bringing his infatuation to an end. But it didn't. It had the opposite effect. It made Edward more desperate, more enthralled to Mrs. Simpson. That was the nature of their relationship. She was a clever woman. She knew the effect her denial, her rejection, her other liaisons would have on Edward. And the heir to the throne had not the sense of duty, royal or filial, to counteract his own wilful, self-indulgent nature, to do what was right. He had never resisted his wants, so he had no practice in it. He had no self-restraint. Christmas 1935 was an anxious time for him. He wanted Mrs. Simpson, but was forced apart from her by Christmas duties he could not avoid. He was convinced by now the only way he could secure Mrs. Simpson for himself was by becoming king. Then, by complete chance, his father, King George, became ill. He had a cold. But colds with George tended to settle on his chest. It was his Achilles' heel. Every time his father became ill, Edward hoped. An unworthy hope. And so he did now. On the 17th of January, 3 days before his death, the king's doctor, Lord Dawson, was called in. Edward arrived at Sandringham too, and during the course of Dawson's treatment of George, Dawson was naturally in constant touch with Queen Mary, and with the heir to the throne, Edward. That this was so was more than a family obligation. It was a constitutional necessity. Edward was anxious also. How could he not be? He loathed his father, and opportunity was knocking on his door. Dawson was the man to do his bidding, an inveterate social climber who prized social distinctions and missed few opportunities to better himself or to ingratiate himself with prime ministers and royalty. And here, with all his other predilections, his love of risk-taking and of exercising power, Dawson had the power to be kingmaker. We don't know what passed between Dawson and Edward, but it seems to me that it is beyond any kind of reasonable doubt that it was Edward who informed Dawson that he would not want to see his father's life prolonged. It was he who expressed this, not his mother, nor anyone else. No one else had the motive or desire for it. The means was present to him in the form of his friend Dawson, whose own instincts were in accord. The things that are said between men about such matters is one thing. What is unsaid speaks louder. The way looks are exchanged, the way Edward's gaze lingered on Dawson's when he reached the word prolonged. It was in such unspoken moments they understood each other. Edward wanted his father dead. Dawson knew it. It is this his diary alludes to in the invisible lines between its curiously vague and defensive self-justifications. George was kept heavily sedated at Sandringham House. Visitors found the king drifting in and out of consciousness. He was fast in the arms of morphia. In fact, this only worsened his condition by suppressing his cough reflex. What did Nurse Catherine Black know of the matter? Enough. But such information in her hands was useless. Dawson knew this. He had a boundless faith in his superiority to people of her station in life, and to almost everyone else. Baldwin visited the king, his private secretary too, and the Archbishop of Canterbury. They found the king weak, but in a gentle, benevolent good humour. Dawson prepared the ground in an extraordinary manner. The king's death should not be a surprise. He told the prime minister, who told the cabinet that the king's end was coming. He told the press, too, the king's life is coming peacefully to its close. Everyone now expected it. There would be no surprise. What satisfaction it must have afforded Dawson that he could kill the king under the noses of doctors, prime ministers, bishops and princes. We know George V was conscious late that evening when his nurse, Catherine Black, approached him with a hypodermic needle, the syringe containing a sedative to put His Majesty into a deep sleep. And it was now he uttered his last words. He saw the nurse approaching, and he said to her, "God damn you." The king's words are telling. He knew. To all who saw him he was gentle, but he said to Catherine Black, "God damn you." It was completely out of keeping and character with the accounts of those who saw George in the hours and days before his death. Why did he say it? Because he knew. He knew the injection she now approached him with did not bode him well. He probably suspected it was the needle which would kill him. He was weak, too sedated to resist. He may have seen her disquiet, something in her eyes, her suspicions that he was not going to emerge from that room alive. Something told him, with a terrible, unerring instinct, he was going to be murdered. "God damn you," he said. His brutal words were the last kick of the condemned man, as the trapdoor swung open beneath his feet. He then drifted into unconsciousness, and Dawson got to work. He looked at his watch. It was 11 o'clock. He left the room and phoned his wife and asked her to call the Times with instructions that they should hold the morning's front-page headlines. A little later he returned to the king's bedroom. He was strangely exhilarated. The power he exercised was beyond anything he had experienced in his life before. Catherine Black, the nurse, was still there. He looked at her. He need have no regard for her. He took a vial of morphine and loaded a hypodermic syringe with 3/4 of a grain of morphine, and he instructed Catherine Black to inject the king with it. She refused. She looked at the syringe as though it was a serpent he offered her. She was frightened. It should have given him pause even at this 11th hour, but he was intoxicated with power. Adrenaline surged within him like a viral infection. He stared at her for a moment. He saw her shrink from him. Then he approached the bed, and steadying his hand on the king's shoulder, he injected King George V with the lethal dose of morphine directly into the jugular vein in his neck, and then injected a grain of cocaine into it also. A short time later, the king was dead. Edward, Prince of Wales, was now King Edward VIII. There is one final point, that is the question of Dawson's committing the matter to his diary. He had no need to do so. Had his act been one of euthanasia, then discretion might have better suited the occasion. But Dawson makes it clear that he has killed the king. Why? There seems to be only one reasonable explanation for Dawson recording his actions in his diary. That is that having returned home and reflected on the enormity of what he had done, and on Catherine Black's refusal to administer the lethal injection, he became worried. He feared Catherine Black might inadvertently or deliberately speak of the matter to someone, possibly to another of the absent royal doctors who made inquiry of her the following day, and that this might lead to an investigation. He would have realized there could be only one charge resulting from such an inquiry, that of murder against himself, regicide, the murder of a king. His recording the matter in his diary was, therefore, insurance against this possibility, a defence in embryonic form. Lord Dawson certainly murdered King George V on the evening of the 20th of January 1936. It is impossible to be certain that Edward, Prince of Wales, was wholly complicit in this act, but to the extent and degree I have suggested, it is highly probable his wishes were fully known to Dawson and played their part in the action Dawson took. Edward did get his way in that he was able to remove his father and marry Wallis Simpson, but he did not make her his queen, nor was he king when he married her. He had misjudged his authority and his powers. He did not recognize or grasp that his obligations were greater than his powers. His hopes that as king his choice of partner would be presented to Baldwin as a fait accompli, and leave Baldwin with little choice but to accept the marriage, were misplaced. He forfeited his kingdom, and was obliged to relinquish his crown to his younger brother George, or Bertie, and went into exile as Duke of Windsor, along with Wallis as his Duchess. After his abdication, his associations with fascists, with Hitler, increased. He continued to have hopes of supplanting his younger brother as king if Germany should win the Second World War. He was in France when war broke out in 1939. His tacit support of Germany continued. He moved to Lisbon early in the war, where his consorting with Nazis and his German sympathies alarmed the government. He was made governor of the Bahamas in an attempt to keep him out of mischief. It didn't. He gave interviews in the U.S. attempting to keep them out of the war. It infuriated the British. Edward believed if Germany was to win the war and overrun Britain, Hitler would reinstate him as king. He was probably right, but his constant flirtations with the German cause and persistent undermining of Britain led Churchill to threaten to have him returned to Britain and tried by court-martial. He was effectively muzzled. Edward and Wallis spent the rest of their lives as celebrities of a kind, mostly in France, where their closest friends were Oswald and Diana Mosley. Edward died in relative obscurity in Paris in 1972 at the age of 77. Wallis Simpson died in 1986 at the age of 90. Both were buried at Frogmore Royal Cemetery in Windsor. After George V's death, Lord Dawson continued as physician to Edward VIII for his short, uncrowned reign. The man whom he had made king, and curiously enough, within weeks he was elevated to the highest rank of the peerage available to him, as Viscount Dawson of Penn. A suitable reward, perhaps. Of course, people whispered. Other royal doctors exchanged the knowing looks, and it was probably they who invented the popular and telling rhyme, "Dawson of Penn killed many men. That's why we sing, God save the King." When Queen Maud of Norway died in 1938, it surely confirmed their suspicions. After Dawson died in 1945, the entry in his diary was discovered by his biographer, Francis Watson, who decided against including it in his 1950 biography out of respect for Dawson's widow. It was not until its publication in 1986 that its full import became known, and then its reception was curiously muted. Discussion inevitably centred on the rights and wrongs of euthanasia, rather than the first principle of inquiry, as to what precisely had happened and why. It was left to foreign newspapers to report the truth. There it was reported that King George V was murdered. No one in Britain would dare say it. The death of King George V in 1936 was met with a great outpouring of national grief. Perhaps such mourning was for the passing of an old order of monarchy, an intuitive realization that things were changing, and that even the panoply of monarchy could not last forever. The notion of constitutional monarchy provides only an interim model for a government in transition, a government on a journey which must inevitably lead to another concept of government, be that one of representative democracy in function, or one more appropriate to the modern age. The idea of hereditary monarchy is a medieval one, itself a natural development from that of old tribal chieftains squabbling for land. If we are wistful for its loss, then it is a wistfulness for old traditions, for simpler times, a nostalgia for the good old days, even though we know in our hearts they were no such thing. George V did have his way in one respect. His dearest wish was that the crown should pass to his second son, Bertie, and thereafter to his granddaughter, Elizabeth. Lilibet. It did. She is still queen today, 95 years and counting. George V's funeral took place on the 28th of January. At 12:15 a.m. his four sons undertook the vigil of the princes in the great medieval hall of Westminster. The princes royal stood guard, in full military uniform at their father's catafalque, as they awaited dawn. In the morning the coffin was mounted onto a gun carriage, and as the cortege moved out of the great hall, the imperial crown fell and rolled in the gutter in New Palace Yard. Perhaps it was an ill omen. Along Horse Guards Parade the cortege passed, bound for Hyde Park, and thence by royal train to Windsor. The five regiments of guards stood sentinel upon its way. At Windsor, the Lord Chamberlain broke his staff of office and laid it upon the coffin as it was lowered. His office was done.